You know, of course, from Benjamin Franklin that there are only two certainties in life, one of which is taxes, and the other is the thing we normally don't talk about, which is death. And indeed, we try not to think about it. But sometimes it's unavoidable. It forces itself on your attention. For example, recently I was renewing some of the domains for which internet domains for which I'm responsible, and I was offered a fantastically good deal if I renewed for 7 years on one of these domains, and so I did. And then I thought, what age am I? Yes. What are the statistical chances of me being around to renew it again at the end of 10 years? And I thought, well, I don't know. But the really interesting thing is, what would happen to that tangle of PHP code and Drupal sites and all that other stuff that constitute my digital assets? And who would figure it out? And at that point, I suddenly felt grateful that we had the foresight to book this particular seminar. So it is an intriguing topic, and one that people, I think, have not yet begun to address enough, and which is why I was very pleased when Lillian suggested it. Now, a few words about the speaker. I, first of all, came across Lillian through her book, Law on the Internet, which is, I think, standard work and has been for years, and I'm going to get her to sign it later. Her principal research interests are in the law of life. This is Cambridge behind us. We like to archive things. Her principal research interests are in the law relating to the net, the web and new technologies, with a European and comparative focus, which means that she spends an awful lot of time on Eurostar, I think. She's been the author, co-author of a number of really important works, and she's been worked in all kinds of different universities, Strathclyde, Edinburgh. She was at Southampton, and she's been a visiting scholar and an invited lecturer in all kinds of other places. So she's really a very mobile, well-known, internationally celebrated academic. And the other thing is that her Twitter stream always reminds me of that passage in the Bible about the peace of God, which, as you know, passeth all understanding. And when I follow her Twitter stream, I think, what a dull and uninteresting life I have. So from that provincial standpoint, I'm extremely glad to have her, and I'd like you to welcome her. We'll...
Thank you. I'm sorry for holding you all up. As I say, you should never work with, was it children, animals, PowerPoint, or me? Because this seems to happen about every second PowerPoint I give, as Daddy will say. And also, I just want to be really lovely, actually. This has just occurred to me. And say how glad I am finally to be invited to speak in Cambridge. You know, as someone who graduated, not from here, but from Queens a very long time ago. And it's just really lovely to be back. It's just sort of hit me. Right, let's get on with things. I can't see this at all, actually, so it's going to be interesting to see how this works. Yay. Okay, death and the web. This is the obligatory lolcat cartoon. All of my PowerPoints have a lolcat in them to sort of soften you up before the bad stuff. It was usually related to data protection. Death and the web. It is interesting that no one ever mentions death and social networks, pretty much, except occasionally when it makes a nice Daily Mail headline, when it's something like suicide clusters in Bridgend, you know, or Laurie Drew in the States, and people doing very, very strange things, which then drive other very strange people to unfortunate suicide. But these are one-offs. These are the pathology, you might say, the pathological cases. The reality is that there are now more than 400 million people on Facebook alone, of whom a substantial portion are probably going to be dead tomorrow. You know, I mean, if you took some percent of that, I don't know what the statistic would be. Even the British survey I saw from 2007, which, as you know, is light years ago in internet dog years, said that the average age of a Facebook user in the UK was 34, which is somewhat higher than I expected. Of course, it will have gone up since then, probably. And indeed, not last Friday, but the week before, when I was, oddly enough, giving my inaugural lecture on Facebook-related topics at Sheffield, was Silver Surfers Day. Don't know how many people knew that. And again, I'm afraid some of those people will probably snuff it soon. So this is becoming an issue.
Just to cheer you up.
Yes, I'm glad to see someone's laughing at this. So I started looking at it. I've actually actually been interested in this rather arcane topic since actually about 2005, believe it or not, when I gave a talk about different types of virtual property, because then and now there's been a lot of interest in one particular glamorous end of this spectrum, which is virtual assets in massively multiple online role-playing games, or mumupapugs, as I call them in my circles. And there was a great deal of fuss at one point about people selling and buying magic swords in EverQuest or World of Warcraft and buying, that space station on Project Entropia for $330,000, I think, which is the most anyone's ever admitted to spending on a digital asset in public. And there was, a certain amount of hubbub, as still is really in certain circles, about the nature of these digital assets, these assets that were bought and sold in virtual games. And I thought, well, actually, there's a lot of digital assets going around, and I will give you a list of some of them, but everything from your Facebook profile to maybe what you write on your blog to the emails you have stored on Hotmail or Gmail or Yahoo or in the cloud, to your login and reputation on eBay, for example, the resolution of your negative and positive feedback. And I tried to come up with some grand unified theory of virtual property, in which I think I failed, but I retained an interest ever since in keeping an eye on this area, which has mutated but has received staggeringly little academic attention, actually, though the media are now quite interested in it, and in fact I get rung up about it about every 2 weeks. And I've appeared in the most bizarre selection of magazines talking about it, everything from some Swedish lifestyle magazine called Bonn to the biggest Jewish weekly in America. So it gets you around, does digital assets and death. So, I'm talking not about this kind of death, which is the blue screen of death, and you can really date the audience by who laughs at that and who goes what. I'll probably get rid of that slide soon. I'm talking about this kind of death. I'm talking about real death and digital assets. It's a rather bad cartoon. Don't worry if you can't read it. It says halfway through the upload, it crashed. And he hasn't got his feet. So, the real stuff. The issues that I'm interested in, and I say I've tried to skew this a bit towards expecting a predominant audience of perhaps of librarians and archivists, but also I know there'll be some techies and some lawyers. Who owns digital assets when you die? And one of the key issues here in the era of Facebook is it you, the creator, the person who made the profile or the blog or the email, or is it the platform, Facebook, Yahoo, Gmail, YouTube, whatever? That's a big issue that I'll be coming to. If it is the latter, and as we will see, it often seems to be, then what's the issue on death? How will the heirs, the people who'd like to get some control over or access to this asset, perhaps because they want to monetize it, perhaps just because they have sentimental interest in it, how are they going to access it? How could they delete it if they don't like it? How could they preserve it if they were, as some of you will be, interested in cultural archiving and heritage? There are very likely conflicts here. I mean, succession is always a very conflicted area. And when you come here, you now have three parties, essentially. You have the wishes of the deceased, you have the wishes of those who come after, the heirs or the successors, and you have the intermediary platform. So we have three parties that might be competing in this environment. Another question is, are we only interested, and I suppose my we here is as lawyers, actually, are we only interested if there's money in it, effectively, which is when lawyers usually get interested, or are we also interested if there is what I call dignitary from the IP world, or sentimental, or personal, or persona interest in material, which will often be the case for a lot of digital assets. And what's the public interest in all this? Which, as I say, I think revolves around the idea of cultural heritage and the public interest. So that's where I get to why should this audience care? And that was assuming that this audience was predominantly people involved in perhaps libraries, museums, heritage, archives, etc. Back to that. Here's one example. Here's something you can find on the web. You can find everything on the web. You can find scanned in love letters from Robert Burns. I think possibly this is here because the first time I gave this talk, it may have been Burns Day. I won't read it out. But the obvious point is that once upon a time, this would have been written on paper as a letter. It might have been inherited by heirs, it might have been sold at auctions, it might have gone into private collections, it might have been archived in a museum and a library. I don't know where this particular letter is. This letter now might well be an email. It might be a song on YouTube. It might be a mashup song using other people's intellectual property on YouTube or some other similar platform. It might be on Facebook. It might be written on somebody's profile. It might be on a blog post. I think you can see that the crucial difference here is that all these platforms are under the control of a second party, an intermediary, in a way that we haven't previously really had to deal with in the field of literary or cultural heritage. So I think this is an issue, especially for the public interest people. Try pressing the right machine. And I think, you know, a way of situating this, you could say, in a Ponzi way. I got involved in a project called Digital Lives, which had the British Library involved in it and the AHRC. I think some of you may know of it. I only got involved very much at the end. I can't really claim any credit here. It seemed a terribly, terribly interesting project. And one of the issues was, where do we document our lives? You know, so there's always been people writing diaries. There's always been people writing letters and obsessively collecting them and selling them. And I learned everything I know about the intellectual property of letters actually from reading A.S. Byatt's Possession, which I would recommend to anybody. It's absolutely fascinating discussion on it. But clearly there is a very long-standing literary and cultural tradition of this. So it's nothing new. So what's new? Well, what's new is, as I say, first of all, I think the intermediarisation that I've been talking about, the use of the second-party platform, and also the fact that we have more archiving than ever before. You know, as in letters would have disappeared, diaries would have disappeared, got lost, thrown out, burnt by your mum, all that sort of stuff. Now everything practically can be preserved, so we have got this incredible likely resource for future generations, for political historians, for cultural historians, and also far more obviously can be shared than it ever was before. You know, I mean, the whole idea of a diary once was that it was something private that no one read. You know, you put a hair over it so you could tell if anyone else had opened it. We're not in that world anymore. I mean, I have a fabulous quote, damn, I should have brought this, which I will now mangle, from Gustave Flaubert, as in Flaubert's parrot, who said something like, it's far too vulgar to disclose secrets to strangers. And of course, that's what our society is now obsessed with. So we like to share our stuff, we like to preserve it, we like to share it, we like to digitalise it. So it should be a great field for the future world, as I say, of cultural heritage. But is it? So we have... So we have this world now of Web 2.0, or web thingy, as Chris Reeves calls it, of blogs, chat rooms, social networking sites, the cloud, virtual worlds, memorial pubs, etc., etc., etc. And we might ask, what are the libraries doing about it? Are they doing anything about it? Well, the answer is, they're trying, actually. Some of you, I imagine for this audience, probably quite a lot of you, probably noticed this one, which this is the Library of Congress, I'm sorry if it's too small, on their Twitter account, saying, Library of Congress to acquire entire Twitter archive, all public tweets ever since March 2006. Details to follow. And there was much excitement in the Twitterverse about this. I mean, you can see even when I captured this, it was retweeted by 100-plus people. Of course, Twitter's only one social network. It is one where a surprising amount of interesting political discourse goes on, I think, so I think this may be a valuable step. It won't include private tweets, the ones that people restrict to a restricted friends list, and that could be seen as a gap, as making the archive very partial. On the other hand, quite a lot of people have said, I didn't know this was going to happen. I didn't know people were going to be able to read my tweets in the Library of Congress, and I certainly have been guilty of making the indiscreet drunken tweet or two, although I usually go back and delete them. So again, right at this early stage, really, of I think of the library world beginning to wake up to the archiving of heritage and Web 2.0, we already have this intrinsic problem between privacy and, as it were, the public interest. You know, what do we think should be preserved and open and digitised and searchable, which is another key issue. Again, people have been in two minds about the fact that Twitters are now searchable on Google, which does make them just that much more public, really. I mean, I get a Google alert on my name every day, I'm that sad. And sometimes my tweets come up in it now, which is always a bit of a shock. You know, previously it was always things like, you know, I said something in the Sunday Times or something. But now it includes tweets and me saying, well, I had sausages for breakfast. So there's a real patent conflict between, I think, privacy and archiving here, which Web 2.0 is bringing into a new focus. Of course, this is not entirely new, what the Library of Congress is doing, though it probably is new in the Web 2.0 world, but there's always been internet archives. Again, this is one that I suspect a lot of this audience will have heard of, which is Brewster Cowell's Wayback Machine, which I believe has been going since about 2006, where he's just basically archiving everything he can get his hands on, everything he can spider or copy, which again, of course, won't include some of the encrypted, password-protected Friends Lock stuff, but doesn't include a great deal of stuff. I'm not sure how the funding is achieved. Once upon a time, it was rather unhappily described as the biggest pile of obsolescent software on the internet, but now I think it should be seen as a good starting point towards an internet archive, and that is Brewster Cowell. But, as you can see, we're in early days on that. Now, as I say, the problem with some of this is that when we come to most of Web 2.0, it isn't going to be available to this kind of archiving, because it is going to be in the walled gardens. So this is Boing Boing, which is the blog of Cory Doctorow, who I know came to talk to this group not very long ago. Yep. Now, as far as I know, and I strongly suspect anyway, Cory and his friends not only write this, they will own it, it won't be on a proprietary site, it's probably on their own server. If Cory gets knocked over by a bus tomorrow, it's going to be relatively easy to transfer it on to his heirs or his successive editors or to archive it or to stick it in the British Library or whatever. Yeah? But most of us aren't Cory, probably luckily. What we do is this. We use the walled gardens, right? So here is, slightly out of date, my Facebook profile. And then we have the problem that they are designed in two ways. They're designed, firstly, that to access them, you have to get their permission to go into the walled garden, which means you have to sign their terms and conditions, or you have to accept their terms and conditions, click their terms and conditions. There's no way in otherwise. Secondly, which gets less publicity, it's hard to get the data out from the walled garden. They are designed technically, generally, to be non-interoperable, and then legally, the terms and conditions nearly always, I think certainly on Facebook, say that trying to achieve interoperability, trying to extract or export the data, is a gross breach of the terms and conditions, which will probably lead to your account being deleted and your data being lost. Yeah. So that happened, for example, to a guy called Scobie, because you're only allowed to have, I think, 5,000 friends on Facebook, and he wanted to have more. So he tried to export his friends list, and Facebook found out and deleted everything, and he started an enormous internet campaign about it. I don't know if anyone here knows him. He sounded a bit over the top. But the point is that the essence of the business model of a site like Facebook, which makes money from monetizing the personal data that you give, is that they want you to join, they want you to stay, the network effects will then encourage more people to come in, they don't want you to leave, and they don't want you to leave with your data. And that is why I call it a walled garden. Yeah? And that is where the majority of the digital cultural heritage, not necessarily Facebook, but all these other places like Blogger, Gmail, YouTube, whatever, that's where the majority of the, you know, the post-millennial digital cultural heritage will be created. Yeah? So that does seem to me to be an issue that we've got to address at some point. Let me retrench a little bit and run down then some types of virtual assets, because I've been sort of airily referring to this. This is a picture I found on the web. If you can't see, it does appear to be somebody who's linked up a small coffin to their PC. I don't know why, but it's a nice picture. So what kind of assets might we be talking about here, which is an interesting thing to do to see if we want to talk about any general legal rules or principles. First of all, I've mentioned Facebook profiles quite a lot because they're high profile in the media. People know about them. There is this idea now, particularly among the young, if young people die young, sadly, of getting their profile memorialised, of turned into a kind of living memorial, and that's becoming a big cultural issue. I've mentioned blog site posts where we might see the early works of future major novelists. There's lots of fan fiction there. Most of it's terrible, but some of it will turn out to be of some kind of lasting archiving interest.
Come back.
There's photos. Flickr's perhaps the premium site here. A lot of those photos have both economic value as well as sentimental value. We are already seeing the odd court case around the world about people complaining that their Flickr images, their photos on Flickr, have been appropriated and used without their permission in high-profile advert campaigns. Videos, again, they might be of sentimental interest, they might be of historical, cultural interest, they might be of purely sentimental interest. There's a lot of them on YouTube, on Google Video, on all these kind of sites, on Dailymotion. Shouldn't just be Western-centric, obviously. There are lots of these sites around the world. eBay is one I think I briefly mentioned. It's slightly different. There are a lot of small businesses that basically run solely on eBay. If you imagine, and this, if you start to look at the letter pages and the blog pages about this sort of stuff, you find a lot of people complaining that, say, their father died and didn't leave them the eBay login, and they couldn't find it, they couldn't find the user ID, they couldn't find the password, they couldn't get it from eBay, then they lost the goodwill, they lost the transactions, they couldn't fulfill things, you know, they lost the reputation, etc. So there is a serious economic interest in transmission, both, I think, of eBay logins and indeed of eBay reputations. And there are reputations, of course, on other sites like Slashdot and so forth. The reputational model is one that is expanding in the Web 2.0 universe. And I think this is a very interesting legal point about whether that reputation is any kind of proprietary asset, which I think is a very open question. Emails, I've already mentioned, emails can be utterly vital to a business. Again, the blogosphere abounds with stories of firms that lost hundreds of thousands of orders because someone died and didn't leave the password and they couldn't fulfil sending out any of the orders, etc., etc. Laughs.fm is an interesting one I came across. Does anyone here use Laughs.fm? Me occasionally. As I understand it, I'm really not going to try and explain this. Last.fm is basically internet radio, but it has this nice little twist that it sort of pays attention to the songs that you prefer to listen to, rather as Amazon pays attention to the books you tend to order. And it uses those preferences to improve the kind of internet radio channel it then serves you. And it actually uses those preferences in aggregate to improve the quality of the songs, the type of the choice of songs it serves to everybody. So the interesting thing that we'll come to is that Last.fm see this as a kind of collective asset of the site. But again, you know, you can imagine in the future, if we could know now, what did Shakespeare listen to while he was writing his plays? You know, what did Browning listen to while he was composing the odd poem? You know, wouldn't that be interesting? I'm not an archivist or a music librarian. But it seems to me that is the kind of thing, again, that we could be preserving for the future. And at the bottom, because I'm bored with it, we have the most well-known virtual asset, which is your magic swords and so forth, your accounts, your virtual currency, your gold doubloons from the virtual worlds, the gaming worlds, etc. Yeah, so that's my rundown of all the types of virtual assets I enumerated. I mean, there are more. I mean, for example, I came across the fact that there's a black market in selling software vulnerabilities. That's kind of interesting. That's a digital asset. I have no idea what kind of property asset it is. There's a bit about that in the new edition of the book. Plug. So, this is really the point I've been making. I won't dwell on it. Who owns digital assets when they're made in social networking sites, in walled gardens, on proprietary platforms? It's important, not just Facebook, but we also are looking at Twitter, Blogger, Google, YouTube, etc., etc. Interesting, we're not just looking at text, we are looking at pictures, we are looking at videos, we're also looking at relationship maps, which I'm told are very valuable. Friends of a friend data, as they call it, is one of the ways in which we map the world and who's connected to who and with how many links, and is being used extensively, I know, in semantic web research and so forth. So that's something that you can get very, very well from these kind of sites. And what do we think about how these sites deal with our personal data? Well, this is a topical issue, I think some of you will know. And indeed, this is what I was talking about for hours a week last Friday at my inaugural lecture, so I'll try to cut that down. But clearly we know that some of the sites, like Facebook, do not seem to have had a good record, really, on paying attention to the users' desires and needs in terms of control of their personal data on these sites. And that's a big issue about privacy during life. Is it also an issue about ownership and indeed privacy and persona rights after death? Yeah, which is what I'm getting onto here. So let's take the example of Facebook because it's the best documented example. Now, unfortunately, talking about the Facebook terms and conditions right now is like talking about shifting sand, or possibly quicksand. I just got the email from Facebook saying, "We're sorry, we didn't mean to steal all your data. We'll never do it again. Please go and check your privacy settings." So I did have a look at the privacy terms and conditions last Friday. Could have changed again by then. But this was accurate as of last Friday. There's two aspects to this with the non-lawyers, really. There's control of your personal data, which generally falls in Europe within the remit of something called data protection, which is often seen as an aspect of informational privacy. Who is allowed to do what with your personal data? Are they allowed to process it? Are they allowed to sell it? Are they allowed to pass it on to marketers? That sort of thing, yeah? Then there is ownership of data. So, for example, if you put a poem on your Facebook profile, there is the issue of intellectual property. Who owns the copyright in that piece of literature? Because a poem, however bad, is a piece of literature with sufficient originality. There will be copyright in it. Similarly, a song, similarly a video, similarly a theatrical performance, etc., etc. So there are these two aspects always, DP and IP, data protection and intellectual property. Facebook basically grabs all of it, if it can. As I say, the situation of privacy is in flux. But even though it's in flux, as far as I can see, Facebook will still be entitled, essentially, to collect all of the personal data you supply, to store it, to sell it, admittedly in aggregate and probably anonymised at the moment. But it looks like that will continue. What's perhaps more interesting, actually, for this topic is copyright, which has had a lot less attention, oddly enough. And here, what the Facebook terms and conditions say, and have said for a long time, actually, is you grant us a non-exclusive, transferable, sub-licensable, royalty-free, worldwide license to use any IP content that you post on or in connection with, whatever that means, Facebook. This is called the IP license, and then this interesting little coda, there's a bit in between I've cut out. This IP license ends when you delete your IP content, when you delete your profile. I'll come back to that. So basically, the important word there perhaps is non-exclusive. So you are giving away the rights to your eternal, deathless poem that you put on your Facebook profile to Facebook to use as they like, but it's a joint license. You've still got it too. Yeah? So you might say there isn't a problem. You can leave that poem to your heirs or to your literary executor. But there is a problem because the problem is access. You know, it's a walled garden. If you die and your heirs don't know your password, they're just not going to be able to get into that information easily. Even if you left your password in an envelope, which is what I generally suggest, the low-tech solution, it's almost invariably on almost every social network, including Facebook, a breach of terms and conditions to pass on your password, which means that if Facebook found out, that they could then delete the entire profile with all the information, including your home. So it's not really an ideal setup. And as I say, the whole nature of the walled garden business model is that it's made both technically and legally difficult to export any of the data, including your home and your friends list and all the rest of it. So even if you get this idea before you die that you're going to get all this stuff out, it's not technically very easy, it's not legally very easy. Yeah. And then we come to the issue of how does Facebook, as my kind of test case, suggest that you deal with these issues on death? And in fact, Facebook is in fact a market leader here, which is a bit worrying. They are the people who have to pay the most attention to this, simply through market pressure. And what Facebook have got is a form. Has anyone ever seen this form? Has anyone ever noticed it on the site? Hey, it takes quite a bit of digging to find it. It's sort of buried in a link in the middle of the privacy policy that's now longer than the US Constitution, if you saw that note in the New York Times. I don't quite know why it's in the privacy policy. It seems to me it's more about IP than privacy, but there it is. So what does it say? It says that you can apply if you have a relationship to the deceased and you can ask for certain very limited things to happen. You can ask for the profile to be deleted. You can ask for the profile to be memorialized, which means that it's restricted to being viewed by the friends list only. It's made friends only. And basically, it's put into ASPIC. Nothing can happen to it. And occasionally, I think, very sensitive data that's there might be removed. I think perhaps if it had been, you know, disturbed things leading up to a suicide or something like that. But basically, it's preserved. There's no opportunity for it to be carried on by somebody else. There's no opportunity for the password to be passed on to a relative so they could continue to add things to it, or friends could continue to add pictures or tributes or anything like that. And there's no opportunity, which is a point I'll come back to, for the person whose profile it was to indicate what they would like to have happened to it, which strikes me as quite a major gap. I mean, there's about 80 different privacy setting choices on Facebook now. They could have added another that said, when I die, I would like this member of my family or this named friend to be able to access my account and change the password or whatever. I think they don't have that. This is purely anecdotal. I think they don't have that because there's no money in mentioning death to people on Facebook. It doesn't encourage people to consume. It's not the image that social networks want to present. They're about young, happening, dynamic, innovative things, all these words. You do not want to think about dying. That's what having a setting there would do. Legally, there's lots of interesting things here, if I can just be nerdy for a minute. For example, the list of people who are related, there's no relation whatsoever to the actual next of kin order of succession in, I think, either English or Scots law. Possibly it does in some US state law, I'm not sure. It doesn't really allow for conflicts. You know, if somebody writes in who's a friend and says they want the profile memorialised, what happens if later on the spouse or the parent turns up and says, well, I want it deleted? We have no idea. It all seems to be in the lap of the gods. Yeah?
I'm sorry, do you need to have a Facebook account to report someone else is dead?
I don't think so. It's a good question. I don't think so. I shall check. And also there is a lovely legal issue here, which is what is the situs of the asset? I mean, where is Facebook? Where is the server? If you think about Gmail, this gets even worse. I mean, I don't know if Cambridge is doing this, but half the universities in this country are now putting the staff and student accounts onto Gmail or Google Mail, yeah, because it's cheap. And it means they don't have to worry about maintaining the servers. And that means that all these emails are in the cloud somewhere. We don't know where Google keeps its servers. They don't tell us. You have to find this stuff out from people like Ross. And, you know, that raises the issue of what is the choice of law, what's the jurisdiction, what's the procedural law. It's wonderful. It's enough to keep lawyers in money for years. So, that's going to be my invention. It's the Lex Citis domicili something or other. Digitalis. So, very quick summary so far. Where are we at? Observations. We have intermediarisation. It's a problem. There's always a second person you have to go and ask to release the asset or to give you access to the asset. Propertisation. This is one I haven't gone into too much here. We really don't know if a lot of the assets I've just mentioned have conventional intellectual property protection at all. Does a password, does a tweet, does an eBay reputation. These are not conventional items of either copyright, trademark or patent. What are they? They might be chosen in action. I'm not even sure how to pronounce that. I'm not an English lawyer. Did I say that right, Dave? Parties, we've got this problem that there are at least three parties involved in disputes and we don't know which should take precedence. You know, there are issues if you break this down. We often feel that creators should have the say on what happens after their death to, you know, what they created, the fruits of their soul, etc. This idea of moral rights. Yet on the other hand, we often have the feeling that the heir should get control of anything that's worth money. And then, of course, we have the public interest, the cultural heritage, the common heritage. And we have this point I just made about the fact that we don't know what law is controlling any of this. I will sort of skip over this and people can ask me questions about it if they like. You have to keep doing this because practice keeps changing. But the basic point is if you look across various types of assets like email, like eBay reputations, like last.fm profiles, like photos on Flickr, you find complete disparity in practice. Yeah. So, for example, a key outstander, if you like, is Yahoo, who interestingly control not just Yahoo emails, but also Flickr. They own Flickr, so the photos on there go by their privacy policy. And the Yahoo privacy policy is very, very strict. And it says that the account is terminated on proof of death, all the emails are deleted, and the login is not transferable. Because it is interested in preserving the privacy after death of the creator of the asset, the writer of the emails, the taker of the photos, as opposed to any interest of the heirs, yeah, which is slightly different than the Facebook model. And there has been, in fact, the one known legal case on this, which involved a US Marine who got killed in action, I think in Iraq. And his family got sent his letters back, his physical letters, in a package. And then they said, well, where are his emails? Because most of the time we communicated with him by email. And it was a Yahoo account that the army was using. And they said, well, talk to Yahoo. And Yahoo said, well, we have this very strict privacy policy which says that actually we delete this account and we don't let you near it, we won't give you the password, we won't give you the emails. And they went, the hell you will. And they went to court, got a court order, went back to Yahoo, and Yahoo did cave, but only to the extent of putting all the emails, which luckily still existed. They had deactivated the account but not actually deleted it. They put the emails on a CD-ROM and sent it back to the family. So it was kind of this wonderful Solomon's compromise, I thought, actually. But clearly, there's a problem here. I mean, it's very easy to say Yahoo's in the wrong here. Poor family, you know, old dead son. On the other hand, what if the son had been hiding out the fact that he hated being a soldier, that he was a coward, or that he was gay, or that he'd had an affair, or something that he really didn't want his family or his heirs to know? Do we believe in the privacy after death of the dead? Maybe we don't. You can't sue for defamation after you're dead. Whether you have privacy rights after death is very much out for discussion. You can't sue in data protection after you're dead. Those rights end with death. We're back into this issue of whether there are rights that should go on after death and whether there are rights, more economic rights, that do tend to go on. So we have all these disparities. No one seems to know what happens to Hotmail. And I'll just mention, yeah, the last FM one was quite interesting. Somebody doing, I think, a student project ran up last.fm. I'm afraid I have not managed to do this myself. And they said, we regard all the preferences of all the people involved in our site as a collective enterprise towards creating the best experience for all our users, and therefore we will under no circumstances delete anything. Unless you really persuade us, I think they added. So there's the kind of the opposite end. And of course the model, as many of you will know, in the commercial gaming sector is pretty much that they own all the assets, so if you died, you wouldn't have anything to pass on, no matter what they were worth, because that's what you agreed to in the terms and conditions. So, Another summary, okay? First of all, on a very practical level, it's very hard to find this stuff out. You know, as I say, it's a kind of ongoing process of gathering anecdotage, ringing people up, reading newspapers, etc., etc. Secondly, if there's a norm, it is that everything is under the control of the platform. And therefore, the rights of everyone else are essentially discretionary. This may not correspond to the law, but this is what the practice appears to be. So the relatives, as it were, go cap in hand to Facebook or Yahoo, asking them, please, you know, give us this information. Again, as I say, there is consistency only in that it generally appears that the user, the creator, gets no opportunity, again in practice if not in law, to indicate what they would like to happen after their death. Yeah? And you wonder about the comparison, for example, to something like kidney donation, okay, which is an interesting comparison because we think culturally that means that you get to control what happens to your organs after your death, but actually legally in this country, in fact, it means that your family get to say what happens to your organs after your death, at least at the moment, because the family will always get the veto over the owner of the kidney donor card in English and Scottish practice currently. So where does that go to? Yeah, so here's a couple of principled observations coming out of this. Again, just sort of drawing out the data I've been giving you. We have to think whether digital assets, either as a group or breaking it down granularly, not very probably a word, that should survive death. And as I say, the comparison here is on the one hand between things like defamation, data protection, and some privacy or persona interests, which are generally regarded as dying with the defunct, as opposed to things like copyrights or indeed debts, which are economic rights and which are usually seen as passing on to the named heirs. Yeah? Which is it? We have this issue about the conflict between the privacy of the dead and the wishes of the living, which we saw right back at the beginning of the talk with the Library of Congress tweets, and we just saw with the Yahoo case and the Marine. We have this issue of who rules, and I've already raised this comparison. Generally speaking, in Anglo-American practice, when we think about conflicts between the dead and the living, we tend to prefer the will, I would say, in Anglo-American practice, the wishes of the dead there, to the wishes, say, of the grieving widow or partner by the inn. But then if we take the organ donation model, it is more the survivors, the family, who actually get the veto, the say-so, because it seems like they're the ones who could be hurt by the wrong choice. And there is no real consensus on this. Finally, an issue I haven't raised so far, that I've just thrown in there, even though it's not really an issue of principle, which is what on earth happens to all this stuff if the site goes under? You know, this is going to happen. Just as we saw a lot of businesses go under in the dot-com bubble, we are now going to start seeing social networking sites going under, and Bebo is teetering on the edge, probably to be followed by MySpace, I guess. You know, and what will happen to all those songs, and what will happen to all that data? We have, as far as I can tell, no real rule on this. Okay, so finally, a couple of solutions. First of all, solutions for users, then I might think about trying solutions for the cultural heritage. For users, there are all these sites beginning to set up, this is a new business model, that try to give you opportunities essentially to make digital wills, you know, the safe and secure way to pass your online accounts to your friends and loved ones. This one's had a lot of publicity, this is Legacy Locker that has opened in a number of countries. And it's interesting, you leave your passwords with them, essentially in a scrow. They encrypt them, they then only release them to the person that you say. So they argue that there's no way that they can be interfered with, as it were, even by a court order, because they it's all encrypted. The business model is worrying. The business model is that they send you an email every 6 months, I think. And if you fail to reply to two of them, they assume you're dead. So you left the email saying, I hate you, I hate all of you, and I have three children by someone else. And it gets released because you've gone on sabbatical for a year and forgot to cancel the standing order. So I always think that was a bit not a good idea. And there are similar bunch of sites, this one called Dead Man's Switch, it's free, where again you can leave a bunch of emails that will be released to people when you're dead. However, they establish that fact. As this one starts with shit happens, sometimes it happens to you. It's very zen, it's very Kurt Vonnegut. I think that all of these actually could be subsumed by the nice low-tech solution of putting all your passwords into an envelope, putting it with your will in your lawyer's filing cabinet. That's what I recommend. And, of course, this is still against terms and conditions.
Wouldn't it be illegal to do that? Because we've all signed terms of service with from sharing accounts.
It's not illegal in the sense of being criminal. It's a breach of the contract, which means that if they found out, they'd be entitled to take whatever sanction it names in the contract, which usually includes deleting the data, closing down the account, you know, throwing you to the seven seas. But they'd have to find out. So it's still the most practical solution. Can we just get to the end of it and then we'll have questions? Because I know some people will want to run along. There is a big problem even with this solution because most people don't make wills. This is, again, a little-known factor. Again, it's been years, actually, since I taught succession, and I really must research this, but the old knowledge was always that most people didn't bother to make wills because most people don't necessarily have enough wealth to pass on. That's probably changed. But there's still a great many people who do die intestate, and especially the young. You know, most people really, really won't make a will until they're over 40, probably over 50, because it's just too much of an intimation of mortality. So, again, on social networks, you may well have, unfortunately, the young dying. They are not going to think about either paying money to Legacy Locker or about leaving passwords with a will because they won't have made a will. I think that the more sensible approach here, as with privacy and personal data, would be to think about regulating the platform. And this indeed is what the Canadian Privacy Commissioner has sort of begun to think about. They sort of rapped Facebook over the knuckles a bit last year about their practices in various areas, including this. So we could suggest that, again, as with privacy, there is this idea that Facebook ought to set its defaults at a privacy-sensitive level. Again, why couldn't they put in options that say, when you die, what would you like to happen to your profile? Would you like it to be deleted? Would you like it to be preserved, etc.? Of course, that still raises issues about opposition from the family. Can the user select deletion when the friends want it to be memorialised? You're going to have all those issues. For the non-social networking sites, but more the kind of World of Warcraft type sites, can they argue that their business model depends on them monetizing the IP and that they just can't afford to let this stuff be passed on to heirs or whatever? Is that a viable complaint? And finally, I meant to bring a quote, but probably isn't time anyway, from a science fiction writer called Charlie Stross, who has some wild ideas. I think his future solution for this is disintermediation, which is an interesting one. And again, there may be some techies in the room who know more about this than me. There is this rise of the idea of life logging, logging every detail of your life, of going around the little camera implanted in your eye, rather like J.G. Ballard, watching everything you do. Strauss suggested that you could do that, and he worked out the terabytes of your life that this would involve, and suggested you could put them all in one quite small diamond. I don't know how you would do that, but it was possible. So the idea is disintermediation, that you could life-log onto a medium that you control rather than onto a proprietary platform. So maybe that's the future, but it's a long way off, it seems to me. And as I say, I'm very glad of any information about that. Okay?
Thank you. Okay, we have time for a few questions. Can I just say that never again fail to reply to your emails, by the way. We have time for a few questions, and then I'll go over there.
Yep. Thank you, Ivan. I thought it was a fascinating talk. It's not one way of looking at these services where, I mean, if you take, say, MySpace, you know, you've got a song, you're adding it. Mm. Can we not see them more as effectively a service to which you are requiring a copy of your information, and effectively the responsibility is on you to maintain whatever assets locally, on your own systems or whatever. And that you're really just getting a copy of the services, and as such, the services basically have no responsibility to do,
It's quite a nice idea. So they would have to set up a mirror of any of your data.
I guess the other thing is, isn't there an extent to which, you get what you pay for? I mean, I pay every month for an email service that is a problem shell that I can have control of. I would like to think that if I die, that my family can talk to the people I'm paying with.
I would check your terms and conditions. Because there's not always a correlation,
well, I mean,
honestly.
It's basically one of my friends, but I mean, the point is that, you know, with the free service, you know, you're sure entirely locked into whatever. So anyway, it's
in 2.7. I quite agree with both those points, actually. The first point, I said that, and that was an interesting practical idea, actually. Yeah, if you set up a Facebook account, they're obliged to set up a mirror of it somewhere that's not a walled platform. That would be, in a way of implementing interoperability or going to a kind of quasi-open source model, which is something that the European Commission is just beginning to toy with, I think, in some of the discussions right now around the Data Protection Directive. The second point, I think, is a really crucial one, which is that we get all this, you know, the chocolate factory, as they call it, we get all this free stuff in Web 2.0 by virtue of exchange for, A, our personal data, and to a lesser extent, our IP artifacts in sites like World of Warcraft. And that is a viable transfer. You know, the question is, at what point does societal concern cut in that we decide that that needs regulated? You know, because at the moment the market's letting it happen. Whether that's a real market or a market driven by ignorance and technophobia is hard to say. And we seem to be at the cultural tipping point where we're saying, in privacy terms, we're not happy with people being left to give away their privacy in return simply for the use of these services, because we're worried about what it might mean for the future. But I don't think we've got to that point at all in terms of preservation and transfer of digital assets on death. You're right. Yeah? Does that answer that?
Yeah, well, just very briefly come back on the first point. I mean, what I was saying is that effectively you're not so much, you know, the site meant for backup and so on. What I was saying is that the site is effectively you know, some kind of repository to which you publish a copy of what you've already made.
Oh, I see.
So you know, you've got a song, yeah. You've saved it on your computer, and you're kind of giving MySpace a copy. But ultimately, if MySpace goes bust, it should be, you know, it's not responsible for the user to actually have their own copy.
It's a bit libertarian for me. Sorry, yeah. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I mean, yeah, that's always the kind of classic web responses, you know, the users can do this stuff, you can always build a bit of tech that will do it, etc., etc. But most people don't. The 400 million users of Facebook won't do that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it's necessarily classical, but I mean, for significant IP, like poems and that kind of stuff, as opposed to ephemeral.
But what about your emails? I mean, I store a huge amount of stuff in my emails as attachments. Mm. You know, and my university is going over to putting those emails in the cloud on Gmail. I haven't really thought this through myself yet. You know, I still rely on feeling that I have control over that stuff, as I did when I was at Edinburgh and I knew the person who ran the server. But very shortly, that will not be true, and I could have, as I did have, that book on that server, and it would not be under my control. I mean, yes, in my more sane moments, I backed it up on various USB sticks, but there would definitely have been points when, you know, that entire book, and I'm sure a lot of people's entire novels, are sitting on their email server.
But everything on Gmail can be backed up onto your own drive.
Sure, but it's a matter of people doing it. People are very inert, and people are not very... People are technophobic, they're ignorant, they're... You know, there's all these things. It's like consumer protection law. People don't do the things that could protect them, and you have to think at what point to get paternalistic about it.
Of course. There's somebody at the back. Yeah, sorry. No, I'm coming. Yep.
So what part of the legal situation are you kind of sketched out a bit what the legal situation is, and it really isn't the legal situation for this kind of digital asset preservation in an online world. But surely digital asset preservation in the offline sense, as in the sense of hard disk of my computer and I don't have the password to, and my heirs don't have the password to get at the data on the hard disk, because they can't log into my computer. Surely that issue has existed for, well, maybe 10, 20 years. And surely there's legal precedent there. Surely there's been some cases where people try to get access to data and some sort of precedent has been set. I'm
not aware of any, actually, because believe it or not, Corey asked me the same thing. He rang me up and asked me, because he was trying to work out what to do with all his data. I think that's where these legacy locker time things come in, is that the idea there is you can put your passwords in a scroll with them and they'll be able to deliver them to whoever. But I'm not aware of any legal precedents, I must say. There might be some from America that I've missed from lower down courts. Do you know any now? It is odd. Again, another sort of little legal wrinkle to throw into this is what you can do that I once did, should I admit this, is you can go out and buy password cracking software if you've forgotten your password for something that will then, you know, find it and get in. That's probably computer hacking. You know, I was only trying to get into my own data, but if it was a third party trying to get into data, it's probably unauthorised access under the Computer Misuse Act and punishable now by, what, 6 months to 5 years in jail? People look worried.
Well, thank you for a very interesting talk. I was just wondering, you kept mentioning European or Scottish or British, English or Canadian. And I was thinking, in my case, I'm not sure which law would actually apply to me because I'm Danish. I made my Facebook and my Gmail account in Japan, and I now live in the UK. So, which, you know.
It's a fabulous question. I mean, I started off my legal career teaching conflicts of law, and this stuff just brings joy to my heart. I mean, there's kind of at least two models here. If you just see the dollars. There's at least two models here, which is that the law should be the law of the place that you were domiciled when you died. So that might be here, or it might be Denmark, and that would be difficult too. Or it might be the law of the place of where the asset was situated, its situs. But that usually only applies to immovables like houses, which would not apply to a digital asset. And when you start to come, is Lionel still here, to the IP rules about copyright, about intellectual property, then you just give up and die, actually. I mean, they are so ridiculously complicated already without even getting to the digital kind of part of it. It's a very, very, very difficult question, I think, would be the informed answer.
Yeah.
Well, they would say that, wouldn't they? As the actress said to the bishop. There is a kind of ongoing issue about this. In terms of data protection law, and you have to divide it up by aspect because the rules are different for data protection, for copyright, for defamation, and they're different for each part of law. The argument for data protection is that the EU gets jurisdiction, which means they get to apply data protection law, if Google use equipment, in inverted commas, which is currently defined to include even putting a cookie on your machine, which Google definitely do. Google are in dispute about this, it would be fair to say, and it is one of the issues that's up for discussion in the current reform of the Data Protection Directive. They're erring on the side of caution. I mean, I think if it ever came to court, these things never come to court, a court would probably, if it was in consumer interests, apply data protection law against Google. But then you've got the issue, of course, of trying to enforce it against their assets, you know, if it came to try to get action out of them. Where are their assets? I mean, there's another example for the Danish person. You could go by the law of the server. That would be a nice, simple one. But as I say, we don't know where Google servers are. I hear rumours that there's one in Dublin, for example. Thank you. Can you give us a little map? I mean, how can you construct certainty? How can you advise people around not even knowing where the servers are? Which is one good reason why this would not be a good connecting factor, as they call it. Connecting factor is that word like cities or server or domicile. No?
Okay. Two more, I'm afraid. Danny, and then there's one back there.
I wanted to pick up your very interesting remark, Liam. Wouldn't it be cool if we knew what various famous poets had been listening to? Because in many cases we are taking a library or archival model there that's not based on individual user consent, but is based on various types of accessed materials of people who are dead, perhaps long dead, and sometimes that can be through intermediaries. So if you have a situation, say, where we talk about a service that doesn't delete people's data, but then enters into discussions in the same way that the Library of Congress has with Twitter. Do you think there's, I mean, obviously that would be a major conflict. Where do you think the balance of rights lies there?
It's terribly difficult. I mean, I think the Library of Congress Twitter one itself is interesting because I know of people who've been quite horrified at the idea that their tweets were going to be archived. And, you know, that's people who've already chosen not to password protect their tweets, you know, not to friends lock their tweets. So you think they've already laid their life on the line, as it were. I think we've had a problem ever since digitisation about this. I mean, public records, for example. Public records are public. You know, it's like you know, stupid cat is stupid. But when you take public records like case reports and put them online so they're searchable, people go mad. I mean, in Latin America and several countries, they've had to start redacting all the names from the online case reports.